Coming up in this podcast, end of financial year, house price data, Power 500 launch, lithium projects, apartment developments, workplace safety, Svetlenko jailed, and Michelle Fyfe resigns.
Welcome to Mark My Words, the weekly podcast from Business News, with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer discussing the important business news and data stories from Western Australia.
Welcome to our weekly podcast and welcome Mark Beyer. First up, Mark, let's wrap up the end of financial year, which was a bit ugly as it turned out.
Well, it certainly finished off on a negative note, but a great time to get some perspective on what we've experienced over the past financial year. The area that a lot of people are focused on is the decline in the stock market and the way that's flowing through to benchmark returns on superannuation funds.
Yep.
And generally, we're looking at losses of sort of 10 to 11% across the stock market.
Yep.
and super funds as well. So disappointing, but to put some context around that, that followed a rise of around 25% in the previous financial year.
That's right,
yes. In sort of benchmark stock returns. The last financial year, it'll be the third financial year where there's been a loss in the past decade. So we've had 7 years of gains, 3 years of losses, which is in line with what we've experienced over many, many decades. You get a few bad ones, you get the odd very good one, and you get your average return sort of 9 to 10% positive.
Yeah, and Mark, probably just worth noting, a lot of that period, especially the last 5 to 6, 7 years, has been low inflation environment as well. So those 7 out of 10 positive, a positive return against almost zero inflation is a pretty good outcome, isn't it?
It certainly is, yeah.
Obviously, that's changing.
Yep. Well, in fact, on that point, you look at sort of this, I guess, the broader macro environment, and if you wanted to, you could paint a fairly gloomy picture. Inflation is rising,
yeah.
Interest rates are rising.
Yeah.
COVID is still a factor out there.
Yep.
The war in Ukraine, the disruption that's causing to supply chains, to commodity markets. I mean, think about supply chains and COVID. China. Still grappling with COVID as a big issue there.
Absolutely.
And yet, despite all of those challenges, the Australian economy is continuing to enjoy very solid growth, and the outlook for Australia is for continued sort of average kind of growth, around that sort of 2.5 to 3% annual growth in the economy. The jobless market, unemployment rate around 4%. So, of course, the flip side of that is labour shortages. But
yeah,
a good problem to have.
What were the numbers overnight? There's something like there's a job available out there across Australia for almost everybody who's unemployed. And in WA, there's 1.5 jobs for every person who's unemployed.
And I guess that highlights this issue that many of the people who are currently unemployed just don't have the skills or capability, perhaps desire, but I think more skills and capability to be productive members of the workforce.
Yeah.
So they need some training or support to be able to enter the workforce.
Yeah, which so, is not responsive even if that was available. And I guess, Mark, again, the Reserve Bank's increasing interest rates. They're trying to stem a bit of this to a degree. I mean, that when you have a situation like labour shortage because business is powering ahead, I mean, this is the natural environment to start putting interest rates up and try and pull demand back, isn't it?
The expectation is that we'll have more of that to come.
Yeah.
So what the official cash rate's, 0.85% now? Most people are seeing it going north of 2%, possibly as high as 2.5%.
And that, of course, by the end of the year?
Over the course of the coming sort of 12 months or so,
okay,
I think.
So financial year, yep.
But we could have the next move as soon as next week.
Yes.
I think the next Reserve Bank board meeting comes up then. Looking at some other areas, commodity prices. Well, it's a good time for commodity prices. Iron ore has come off a bit, but still around $130 US a tonne.
Yeah.
Well above sort of long-term historic averages. Grain prices, very strong, tied in particular to what's going on in Ukraine and Russia.
Yep.
So these are some positives for Western Australia in particular. Also, just tracking back on the stock market, two things I'll point to there. We have our own BN30 index.
Yes.
So okay. We track the share price performance of a basket of 30 Western Australian companies. Very similar to the overall Australian market, perhaps a touch better. So that's down about 9.5% over the past year. So a little bit better than the All Ords.
Yes.
But not a lot in it. And as always is the case, enormous variation depending on what stocks you're investing in. So some of the better performers, IGO, the nickel and critical minerals company, Pilbara Minerals, lithium miner, Woodside Energy, they've all done very well. But there's a few others that have had some big negative returns.
Mm.
And then at a sectoral level, one thing that really stands out is that it's the smaller companies. So there's the Small Ordinaries Index. So you take out sort of the top 50 or top 100 stocks and you look at what's left. That's down 21% over the past year.
Yeah, right.
So if you'd stuck with the bigger blue chip stocks, you probably would have done a bit better.
Right, so their blue chips are more defensive, right? And people will err to that as soon as they get the jitters a bit.
Yeah.
And then I guess flowing on from that, we've also seen the June monthly house price data showing Perth's going up against the trend.
Yeah, and look, once again, this also leads into sort of an annual sort of retrospective on the housing market. So you're right, the June figures, Perth up 0.4%. That's the sort of the median house price. Over the past 12 months, up 5.8%. So not a lot, but I guess it's this continuation of a trend we've seen for quite a long while, where Perth has had solid, okay growth compared to the very big increases that we had seen on the East Coast, which are now coming off the other way.
That's right. Yeah.
So East Coast markets, house prices surged about 30% at their peak. Yet Sydney, they've now seen falls in house prices for the fifth month in a row. And the month of June, down 1.6%. Melbourne, they've had falls for 4 months in a row. Brisbane, they've been growing at about 2% per month. They're now flatlining. So, you know, those markets have had a really volatile period, which, you know, I think we've discussed this before. Not something that's sort of healthy for any market.
No.
When you get this sort of too much speculation coming in, they get too hot. Affordability becomes affordability has been a big problem in Australia for a long time, but it gets a whole lot worse.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, we look affordable, and then I guess people who are less geographically bound to purchase in a particular place look at WA as a possible investment area. You do have there's demand for labour, so people are coming here. And, you know, living standards by comparison are better here. So, you know, that's another attractor. So I guess there's a suspicion we're going to see house prices go up here and continue to go up. But then you've got interest rates rising at the same time. And, you know, and what's really happening in the economy, more broadly speaking.
There's some very different forecasts out there for house prices. Certainly at a national level, there seems to be a consensus that there's already a correction happening and that will continue. And logic tells us, and the experts are saying, that the markets where there's been the biggest growth will have the biggest correction.
Right.
So Sydney and Melbourne will be leading the way, and Canberra, followed by places like Brisbane, Adelaide, Hobart. As for Perth, on the one hand, we've got the Real Estate Institute of WA. They're still sticking to their view that there'll be 10% growth in house prices in Perth in the current calendar year. Damien Collins, president of REWA, his comment is that at the midway point of the year, their calendar year forecast of 10% price growth is tracking well.
Okay.
And yet just about every other, banking groups, economists, they're all still tipping a fall in Perth, somewhere between 5 and 10%.
Mm.
So they're very much at odds with what REWA is forecasting. Shane Oliver at AMP Capital, you know, he's come to this view of 5 to 10% fall in Perth. And I say a lot of the banking groups are looking at numbers around that level. So a bit hard to reconcile, those different forecasts?
Yeah, well, I don't know how market specific they're looking at, or whether they're just, you know, trying to use sort of national data and apply it at a local level. It's always difficult to gauge. That may be a difference in thinking there. And then you've got, I guess it just depends how hot the resources sector stays, right? If this continued volatility happens at an international level and iron ore prices remain high and oil prices remain high and the demand for lithium and those things, which, you know, is sort of, I think, is actually accelerated by the volatility internationally, then those things, and gold remain strong, then you kind of think, well, what's going to drive house prices down here? I'm just not sure. So, we may have a different market in that sense, and it may not be completely red. They may be just looking at the housing market rather than the local economy, in my view.
Yeah, look, I think it'd be disappointing if we did see a fall in house prices in Perth of anywhere but like 5 or 10%. And look, I tend to agree with you. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Fundamentals of the economy are good. Interest rates are going up, but they're still, by historic standards, very low. Affordability in Western Australia is better than any other state capital. Earnings in this state are higher than most other states. So,
and we finally opened the door and allowed people to come in.
That
so
is
there
right.
There might actually be some buyers coming in. So, yeah, look, anyway, I mean, look, of course, the caveat on all that is something big in the world happens in a different way and, you know, iron ore prices come off massively or, you know, anyway, it's difficult to sort of see that in the next 6 months. So, you know, neither you nor I are forecasters. We're just observers. Now, Mark, Business News launched the Power 500 this week. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, look, we had an event down at Central Park. We had a lot of people down there showing very keen interest. So this is a brand new special publication. It builds on something that we've done as an editorial team for a long time now, our most influential feature. So who are the movers and shakers in business and politics in Western Australia? We've taken that and made it a whole lot bigger. A special publication where we name the top 500 people across a whole range of sectors, you know, property, mining, politics, public policy, the people behind the scenes, the politicians. I think we'd agree it was quite a task to put together that list.
Yeah.
You know, the top 50 is pretty easy. Top 100, you know, that comes together without too much trouble. And as you go further down the list. So it was a really fascinating exercise. And it was good to have a team of experienced journalists in here. And, you and I contributed to it. Shaun Cowan, Gary Adshead, Jacinta Burton, other people, sitting around the table, sort of digging deep into a whole range of sectors.
I mean, look, I downplay how much role I played. I think, there was a lot of work done by people before I came back on a more full-time basis. So, and Jacinta Burton, you mentioned there, she's really carried the load on this one. But it's pretty fascinating. I think one of those really difficult things with this process is you've got people who are chief executives of really big companies or even, you know, running the iron ore division of, you know, BHP. And then they've got groups of people under them that do make pretty big decisions. And you're trying to weigh up that the internal people there versus, you know, someone who runs a smaller company and they've, you know, but they're running it at their own, you know, they're the chief executive there. And I think that's, obviously we've erred to the more public people, the chief executives, and I think that's generally right because in the end, all those other groups of people are still answering to somebody above them. But it's a pretty fascinating look. And then it's, you know, it's which is more powerful, someone in the arts or someone in mining and all that sort of stuff. You've got to broaden it, don't you?
Yeah. And look, just to get some to throw a few names into the mix, if we have actually had a top 10 at the start of the publication. The rest of it isn't formally ranked, but certainly the top 10 we've done. So look, number one, we put the Premier, Mark McGowan, well, Premier and Treasurer, and you know, clearly as powerful a Premier as I've seen for a long time, and a state that's doing well, and he's travelling very nicely and dominates the state government. And as a consequence of that, a lot of the people around him feature highly in the book. So, for instance, Dan Pastorelli is the Premier's Chief of Staff, and he's someone that we rate very highly as well.
Yeah.
Then two others that really stand out, Andrew Forrest and Kerry Stokes. Both very wealthy people, but also, you know, deploying that wealth to achieve commercial influence and, I think, sort of public policy and political influence.
Agreed.
But it also means that a lot of people around them, so if you look at Andrew Forrest's sphere of influence, you know, Fortescue Metals Group, Fortescue Future Industries, Tattarang, Mindaroo Foundation, there's a pretty big representation from those organisations.
Yeah.
Likewise, with Kerry Stokes, Seven Group Holdings, Westrack, Seven West Media, The West Australian, a lot of people in his orbit as well.
Yeah, and that's where I was getting to. You see some of those in it, and then it's that challenge, which I think, you know, quite frankly, Business News has done a really good job there, trying to get that broad mix and say, well, look, here's the people that matter. And if you really want to scratch the surface on Andrew Forrest and go down below and who's working for him, that's, you know, that's achievable. And again, you can use our data and insights to find out a lot of that anyway. Yeah, and look, a great event too. So most appreciate your commentary around that, Mark. Now, bringing back to the news of the week out there in the markets, two big ones, Liontown and Pilbara Minerals, have both moved their lithium projects ahead.
More evidence, I guess, of the strength and the scale of the lithium market. Now, lithium prices, they're still pretty volatile, but by historic standards, still pretty strong, and enough to convince these two Perth companies to go ahead with their projects. So Pilbara Minerals, they were one of the early movers into lithium. They've got their Pilgangoora project up in the Pilbara, and they've just committed to expanding production by another 100,000 tonnes per year and continuing to study potential for further expansion beyond that. And Ken Brinston, the outgoing chief executive, he's talked about the fact that when he looks at the global demand for lithium, particularly the electric vehicle industry, he said that they're scrambling to get supply. They're just really keen for more production to come through. And then the other one is Liontown Resources. They've got their Kathleen Valley project up in the goldfields. This is a brand new development. And what really stands out here is that they've got a lot of funding from the Ford Motor Company. They've got plus an offtake agreement. So Ford and Tesla and LG, they've got binding offtake agreements to buy about 90% of the production from Kathleen Valley. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, Ford is lending $300 million to Liontown.
Okay.
Now, Liontown did a big capital raising last year, about $450 million. So that gives them the bulk of the funding. But then when you've got a customer prepared to lend you that much money to ensure that you're fully funded for the development, that's a very important signal about how much the automakers are planning to put into this market.
And didn't, was it last week that Pilbara got investment from one of the new automakers, or am I wrong in thinking that?
Could have been Vulcan Energy.
Yes, Vulcan, sorry.
Yeah, you're so right, Vulcan, they've got the project in Europe, and they also got a substantial backing, I think about $75 million as an equity investment from one of the big automakers. And a comment from Ford, they're saying that by the year 2026, only 4 years away, they expect to be selling about 2 million electric vehicles. And presumably more growth beyond that. So that's just one small example about where this big demand is coming from.
Yeah. Which flies in the face of what happened a couple of weeks ago, isn't it, when there was a research note went out and said, oh, there's going to be too many projects coming on, the lithium price is going to collapse, and, you know, negative, negative, negative. These companies are not seeing it that way at all, obviously.
Yeah, look, that was, I think, Goldman Sachs and Credit Suisse, and that caused quite a blip in the market, and share price of a lot of the lithium stocks fell quite sharply. And look, they're still well off their highs. You know, I mean, I think it's like any new industry, any commodity market, you know, sometimes you overshoot on the upside and they often overshoot on the downside as well.
Yeah.
But this is, I guess, this is the fundamentals, isn't it? You know, when you get an automaker lending $300 million and companies committing to these projects that each of them are worth several hundred million dollars.
And Mark, without digging too deeply into the detail, just remind me, so when Pilbara Minerals says going to do another 100,000 tonnes of?
spodumene concentrate.
Right, which is
that's the, once that is processed, that turns into lithium carbonate.
Right.
So the concentrator is on the mine site, then gets fed into a refinery to produce the lithium concentrate, and then subject to further sort of processing when it goes into the actual manufacture of the batteries.
And how much? So they'll be selling spodumene.
Yep.
Will there be further processing to lithium carbonate in WA?
In their case, they've got a joint venture in South Korea. They're right. building a refinery in a JV up there for their production of the lithium concentrate. But we've still got these three other groups. You know, Tianqi and IGO have got the refinery in Kwinana.
Yep.
Albemarle and Pilbara Minerals are building a refinery in Kemerton down near Bunbury. And then we've got Wesfarmers and the Chilean group SQM. They're building their refinery in Kwinana as well.
Got it.
So three lithium refineries in Western Australia, downstream processing. That's a good story.
Yep, agreed. Next step is just to build some batteries if we ever get to that. Hey?
That's the goal.
Now, Mark, changing tack somewhat, there's been some big news around in the apartment sector.
Perth's had this very slow move away from suburban sprawl to inner suburban apartment living. Part of the challenge, I think, for a lot of the developers is finding the right locations, getting the approvals, and I think getting the appetite from home buyers that that's where they want to live. But, yeah, I think we've had in the past week a few very positive signals. Down in East Perth, the old Perth Girls' School, which some people might have been to in recent years. It's been a venue for the Fringe Festival.
Yes.
But around that historic building, there's land out the back in particular, a large block of land, sort of at the top of the hill in East Perth. Great views.
It was a police station for a while as well, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
It was the East Perth, not the East Perth lockup, it was the East Perth station anyway.
Yeah. So ADC, and which is led by Rod Hammersley, and Warburton Group, which is Tim Roberts' private company. They're the developers behind this project. There's going to be 740-odd apartments there. There's going to be four towers up to 36 stories. And this has gone through final approvals. Now, this is the kind of project where they've been looking at it for 5 years. Rod Hammersley talked about mapping out his vision for the site back in 2018. And one of the things he's highlighted is getting necessary scale to create what they're aiming to be to achieve is a successful inner city neighbourhood.
Yeah, right. You need enough people there that you've got the right shops and there's actually, yeah, because at the moment it's a bit lacking.
Yeah, yeah. So look, this is going to make a really big difference there. Talking about a $400 million investment over a number of years. Also hoping that by the time they start construction in a year or so, some of the heat will have gone out of the labour market and they'll be able to get the people that they need.
Yeah.
And then in tandem with that, we also have the news that just around the corner, Gloucester Park, the historic home of the trotting in Perth, they're looking to partner with Adrian Finney's company, Hesperia, to do apartment developments around the perimeter of that Gloucester Park site. Similar to what is being proposed at Belmont Park on the other side of the river. So that's a project that is moving very slowly. But, you know, another sign here where there's effectively surplus land in the inner city and developers that are keen to get their hands on it.
Yeah, yeah. Mark, interesting though, isn't it, that we had the piece about water bank last week, which is just up the road from Gloucester Park, and Lendlease couldn't get that ahead, and yet here we go, something just near, just up the road. It's fascinating.
Yeah, look, I think with Waterbank, we talked about the fact that there were sort of geotechnical issues there.
Yeah, sure.
That might have been a big factor. But then the other interesting bit of news during the week, Paul Blackburn, he's the developer behind the One Subiaco development right next to the train station in Subi. He came out with details to basically say that project is sold out. They've got about three penthouse apartments. So if you're well-heeled, there might be an opportunity to get in there.
I thought you might have been going up and doing a bit of tire kicking.
But I think Paul you know, Paul's been a great champion of apartment developments in Perth, and he's got several other projects on the go, keen to do a lot more. And look, he's saying that the experience they've got there is that people are keen. If it's the right location, the right quality. I mean, what a great spot. Subiaco, right next to the train station, near all the shops and the bars and so on.
Yeah.
And
look, you know, Mark, I was having this conversation during the week and with Damien Collins, actually, about the, you know, the because he's got his own company, Westbridge, that does do apartment development as well, and talking about how WA Perth is, I think, 6%, or maybe WA is 6% apartments and Perth's about 10%. And whereas you go to Sydney and it's 25%, sorry, New South Wales is 25%, you go to Sydney, it's 30%. And, you know, so that obviously we're tracking towards that at some point. Now, you know, Sydney's a way bigger city and it takes a while to get there, and there are reasons why you don't just leap from one to the other. But, you know, there is sort of a long-term view that if you're investing it, ultimately it's going to work out, I think, assuming the building is done well, which is another element in all this.
Yep, and I think if you get these clusters of development, so you look at other areas, say Canning Bridge is an example.
Yes.
You know, that's been defined as a zone where you can have higher density development, and you get multiple apartment buildings clustered around that area.
Yeah.
And it really should, you know, enhance the vibrancy of that neighbourhood.
It should do, and you're right, it drags the people there, and then you're not just one apartment, you get all the efficiency of the demand, you know, the transport node and the shops and all the other amenity. Yeah, okay. Now, Mark, you have followed workplace safety prosecutions closer than most people I know. There's been several cases this week.
And look, a reminder, if ever one was needed, about the importance of workplace safety, the consequences of it in loss of life, and the consequences in terms of company directors facing substantial penalties.
Mm.
And the three that all came to the fore this week, where there were people or companies that were all sentenced, range from Rio Tinto. This was a case where a truck driver at the Chanar mine died back in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Chanar is an unusual mine because once the trucks are fully loaded, instead of driving up and out of a pit, they actually drive down a hill to the unloading point.
Right.
So there's a 1.2 kilometre long ramp. Anyway, in one case, the truck went down the ramp and it ran out of control, got up to a very high speed and crashed near the bottom. So Rio Tinto was fined over that one. Through to some smaller local businesses, VDM Engineering. When you look at the details of these cases, you know, you shake your head. This was a case where they had some very large pipes that were delivered to their facility in Welshpool.
Mm-hmm.
They were getting offloaded with a forklift. At the same time, the truck driver was taking straps off of his truck on the other side. One of the pipes rolled, landed on top of, and crushed the driver.
Mm.
This was a company where another trucking contractor had previously refused to load trucks at VDM because the company didn't have sufficient safety procedures in place.
Got it.
And yet they found another trucking company that would come along. And then the third example is a company, Resource Recovery Solutions. They're a recycling business out at Bayswater. Director there is Sam Mangione. In this instance, WorkSafe took the very unusual step of stating that this company has a long history of flouting workplace safety laws. One worker died there in 2013. Another worker got a broken arm in 2015 when his arm was dragged into a moving conveyor belt. And then in 2016, another worker died. Now, both the company and Sam Mangione have been fined. You know, this was a case where the worker was reaching into a machine, a sorting machine, to remove some material that was blocking it.
Mm.
There were no guards around it, and his arm was dragged in and had to be amputated at the shoulder. So, you know, when you, it's heartbreaking in one sense. These are very tragic stories. From a hard-nosed business perspective, you know, running a business like that is not very efficient. And for the directors, there is new legislation in place with a very substantial increase in penalties. Mm. So the fines that were handed down in these cases, you know, $70,000, $75,000, $80,000, if these offences happened now and the person was prosecuted, you could expect to fine multiples of that.
Yes.
So it's something for people to really watch out
and
for.
And jail sentences or not?
In extreme cases.
Right.
I mean, we've already had one case of a company director in Perth who's been jailed. There was a roofing contractor.
Right, down in Esperance. Yep.
A couple of young workers were blown off the roof and one of them died. That person's been sentenced to jail.
Mm.
There could be more.
All right, watch this space. Mark, Xenia Svetnenko was sentenced to jail in the US during the week. What are the details there? It's a big story.
It is a big story. And look, we mentioned Jacinta Burton before, working on the Power 500. Jacinta broke this story. She was up in the early hours of Wednesday morning.
Yep.
And sent out a news flash at 6:30 a.m. So look, Xenia, obviously very well known in Perth as a tech entrepreneur, a rich lister, out at all the
big spender.
A big spender. One of the things that he made money from was an auto subscribing service. Well, I wouldn't say service actually, where people, unbeknownst to them, were signed
he's
up
gone to
for
jail, so auto subscribing scam. Let's just be clear.
Yeah, okay. Much better word. people hadn't realised that they'd been signed up for these services.
Yep.
And every month they were hit with a fee of sort of $10 a month or thereabouts to get things they didn't want, like horoscopes and so on, and they couldn't get out of it. Anyway, it got to a point where they pulled in, Svetnenko and his other people who are into it, they pulled about $41 million US from this scam. And Svetnenko was found to be one of the biggest beneficiaries, about $15 million US that he pulled out of this. But look, the Internal Revenue Service and the FBI got onto it a few years ago. They actually tried to extradite him about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
He spent 3 years in Haikia prison.
Yeah, that's the bit that I was surprised about.
Fighting the extradition.
It's a long time.
Before he eventually realised, I assume, that he wasn't going to avoid it. So,
or maybe every avenue was exhausted. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, fair point. So he went to the US, 8 years in jail, and he's had to already pay back $15 million to the US authorities. Now applying to serve his sentence back in Australia with his family.
Yeah, right.
So he's paying a very serious price for what was clearly a very serious offence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a funny thing, isn't it? A serious offence, when you get to the total of it, it is. But I think maybe this is where people like that kind of justify it in their own minds. They're only taking little tiny bits off people, aren't they? It's that micro, it's the micro scam that by doing it and using probably technology that was pretty new in its day, you know, that ability to reach a lot of people, get stuff, lots of sort of AI kind of stuff that he was probably able to use because he had the tech.
This started back in 2012.
Yeah. So really early days for this stuff. And, you know, like just taking a little bit off lots of people, which is what, you know, the rest of us are all dealing with all the time now with our bank accounts. You put your credit card in the wrong place and, you know, you don't even notice that it's going until, you know, you really check your accounts. It's pretty nasty. Anyway, we'll see whether he gets to serve his time here. Be interesting. Now, finally, Mark, another big story during the week was the resignation of Michelle Fyfe from St John's WA.
St John's WA obviously run the ambulance service in Western Australia, and it's quite an unusual model. In just about every other state around the country, ambulance services are run by government departments.
Yep.
But WA has this history where this not-for-profit group has run it and has run it very successfully for a long period of time.
Yeah.
But they're really in the eye of the storm at the moment with all sorts of issues around hospital ramping and service quality in the hospitals.
And COVID, getting their paramedics and drivers and everything.
Yep. So Michelle Fyfe during the week resigned as chief executive there. She'd been there about 4 years. It throws up all sorts of questions about where responsibility really lies here.
Yeah.
And I think Libby Metcalfe from the Liberal Party has made the point that St John's is being made the scapegoat, and Michelle Fyfe in particular, for some much broader issues in the health system, which the government and government ministers should be held accountable.
Yeah.
And I've got a lot of sympathy with that point of view.
But if they're coming from a philosophical stance that they want a private, they want to, sorry, take over the ambulance service and bring it into government, then of course, maybe they do want a scapegoat.
Yeah, and look, that is the, as you're right, that's the wider political context here. The United Workers Union, which very powerful within the Labor Party in WA, they've been public in saying that that ambulance service should be brought within government, and made what I thought were some quite misleading statements, because they characterise St John's, as they talk about it, as a private provider, but characterise it as a profit-driven company, when it's no such thing.
No.
It's a not-for-profit. Also interesting to look at other states around Australia. I was reading just yesterday about major problems in Victoria, and they're not alone.
Yeah.
Where they're having same sorts of problems, not surprisingly, given the magnitude of the COVID issues there, but they found that issues with ambulance service predated COVID.
Funny that.
In Victoria.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the St John, the ambulance stats, they're way better performers in terms of response times than the other states on average. But they got caught up with, you know, some very high-profile deaths where people had to wait up to 2 hours for an ambulance and died, and it's been, you know, a tragedy. And now Michelle Fyfe's sort of paying the price for that.
So, look, the government, a couple of months ago, after one of those deaths, has got more involved. So there are now people from the health department and people from police working with St John's, on to try and improve performance of ambulance services. So government will no longer be able to say that's their problem, because now government is saying they're going to help improve standards. And from here on in, I think there'll be no question where responsibility will have to lie, and it's with the government.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And look, to be fair, in all this process, you know, the government wears it anyway. It's, you know, as much as it was St John's fault and blah, 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 and Michelle Fyfe copped a lot of it, the government also wore a lot of that pain. Yeah, and look, I don't know Michelle Fyfe well. I've met her a few times. I don't know what her management style is. I think she may be a little unlucky here, in the sense that I think she came in as a change agent, and I think she was making big changes. I've spoken to paramedics about this, and there was a really big change occurring about the education levels and the types of people they were trying to get in. They were trying to expand that workforce, but a lot of paramedics were unhappy about that. They were finding themselves working with less experienced people in times which was difficult. But if you need more people, you've got to find a way. So she may have, by upsetting the apple cart a little bit internally, found herself more vulnerable when an external crisis came and delivered the knockout punch. And I don't know, but also I hear things about how the state government, you know, like that, talking about that change where they bring up police and emergency services, that there wasn't a lot of consultation with St John around that. So potentially the communication had become poor. And Mark, just one other thing. I looked in this year's annual report for St John and last year's. Last year, Michelle Fyfe had the big chief executive spiel. You had the chair and then the chief executive spiel. This year there wasn't one. So it's potentially the case that she was already planning to step down. I think she was coming to the end of her term very soon anyway. So she may have been planning to step down. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, those are all just conjecture. Like a crisis like that brings it all forward potentially. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate your time. Hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Mark My Words with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer from Business News. For more information, please go to businessnews.com.au/podcasts. And to receive these regularly, search for Business News WA in iTunes or SoundCloud.